from the west. Tonight, mostly clear, the low 72. The wind will be out of the southwest from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny and hot, the high 97. Heat indices will range from 105 to 110 degrees. The wind will be out of the southwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts to 25. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Expect a low in the mid-70s and a west wind from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Wednesday, mostly sunny, not as warm. The high in the mid-80s with a north wind at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Wednesday night and Thursday, partly cloudy. The low Wednesday night will be in the upper 60s. The high Thursday will be in the upper 80s. Thursday night and Friday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The low Thursday night, the low in the low 70s, and the high Friday in the mid-80s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the mid-80s to the low 90s, most locations reporting sunshine. Rockford reported a cloudy sky and 87 degrees. At O'Hara, it was 86. In Bloomington and Mattoon, 89. At Carbondale, 92. South Bend reported 87 degrees. It was 92 at Lafayette and Indianapolis. And Terre Haute checked in with 89 degrees. Willard Airport had a mostly sunny sky at the top of the hour, the temperature 89, the dew point 74, the heat index 98, the relative humidity 60%, the wind out of the southwest at 5, the barometric pressure 30.09, and steady. And at 12:39, 91 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The University of Illinois is the lead researcher for a $121 million digital network for high-tech academic research funded by the National Science Foundation. The Extreme Science and Engineering Discovery Environment, or XSEED for short, is seen as an expansion of the TerraGrid project, which got its start in the late 1990s. Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert spoke with project leader John Towns about how the focus has shifted to a larger partnership with more top research universities.
TerraGrid can be viewed as a technology-centric project that was delivering high-end resources to academic research projects, and it accomplished some very good things, taking that point of view. Under XSEED, we've taken a different perspective. We are taking a researcher-centric point of view. And so the objective here is really to create these environments for the researchers that facilitate their work. And that forces a somewhat different set of requirements in what we actually deploy and make available to folks. It also opens the set of potential researchers that we can benefit significantly. Currently, we support of order 7,000 individual researchers annually, conducting thousands of projects focused on these high-end resources. It's quite possible as we move forward into this new environment that we could grow that by an order of magnitude, but they would largely be folks not using the very high-end resources, but sharing resources amongst themselves and having access to data stores and other types of resources.
The idea here is more people taking a part in collaborative research projects?
So under TerraGrid, our focus was primarily on supporting academic research by those making use of very large-scale supercomputers. We certainly supported other things, but that was a primary focus. Under XSEED, we're trying to expand the scope of the research community that we're going to support. It's the case that research today is much more collaborative in nature. Grants and other projects involve researchers from multiple institutions. And they really don't have the right kind of infrastructure to support the sharing of their resources, their data, their tools, and just collaborating with one another.
Is it safe to say quantity rather than quality, or size rather than performance of this computer, or is that too much of a broad...
Well, I think the way to look at it is not so much access to the largest resources that are available out there, but how does a researcher have at their disposal everything they need to be productive in their work? Certainly, I want to be clear that we're not losing sight of the need for these high-end resources. It's very important. It's a absolutely necessary set of resources for a lot of research activities to be conducted. But there are many things that do not require those resources. And so with this new project, we're trying to expand our scope and support that community much more effectively.
Can you provide an example of certain projects that are starting up?
One of the larger research teams that we're working with is the Southern California Earthquake Center. And I think this is a great example because people have a good grasp of earthquakes, even us in the Midwest, since we actually have a fault line not too far away. So we've been working with them because what their objective is, ultimately, is to be able to provide input to building codes for construction of buildings that are more resilient to earthquakes, and they focus on Southern California for fairly obvious reasons. Their work involves some very large-scale simulations on high-end systems, coupled with a very large number of smaller-scale simulations on modest systems. And the environment that we're building allows them to construct what we call a workflow that allows them to conduct the entire set of simulations through a single coordinated script, if you will. Whereas previously, they would by hand have to manage every one of these individual simulations, 840,000 simulations for the small-scale simulations. You can imagine doing that by hand is a bit cumbersome. In some sense, what we're trying to do is provide the base level infrastructure that's necessary for science and engineering to move forward in this country. And the analogy to think about is when you think of power grids, the plumbing system, the roadworks, these are all things that are simply there, and many, many people make use of them every day to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish. We're trying to do this in the digital space to support academic research in science and engineering spaces. And so a measure of success for us is if we become almost transparent and people are able to do things much more effectively than they have in the past.
John Towns of the U of I's National Center for Supercomputing Applications, the principal researcher of the XSEED Digital Network. He spoke with WILL's Jeff Bossert. Additional partners in the five-year project, which can be renewed, include Indiana University, Purdue University, and the University of Chicago. It's 12:44. A mannequin maker in Colorado says it can help retailers boost clothing sales by creating more lifelike models. These are custom-made mannequins that look like the real people who shop in stores or the way shoppers imagine themselves. Grace Hood of member station KUNC has more.
In this economy, getting customers to walk to the cash register takes real work, sometimes magic.
Beauty.
That's my favorite.
My fairy aunts didn't know whether to make my dress pink.
In this Southern California Disney store, an employee helps a young customer wave a purple wand at a talking mirror. It's part of the store's redesign, which includes playful child-sized mannequins that encourage shoppers to interact with the merchandise. The mannequins appear to curtsy, jump after balloons, and in some stores, fly.
They definitely look like they're more lifelike.
Terry Cooper is shopping along with her daughter and granddaughter. The idea behind the new mannequins is to show children in real and imaginary play poses. Regional manager Jeff Zimmerman stands near a plastic white castle. On top is a mannequin sitting cross-legged wearing a blue Cinderella dress. He says they can inspire parents
to kind of evoke a sense of imagination of your child maybe wearing that dress and what else to explore in this particular neighborhood.
The 32 redesigned Disney stores are calling their sales very strong for swimsuits and costumes shown on these mannequins. And the company believes the displays played a role in that success. Chains like Athleta, Charlotte Russe, and Dick's Sporting Goods are also putting money into the new mannequins. And that's boosted sales for one of the world's largest custom mannequin makers, Fusion Specialties.
So I have a maquette here that I've been working on.
Outside of Denver, sculptor Ileana Barbu is carving a 2-foot clay sculpture, one of the first stages in creating a custom mannequin prototype. Next to her, gray limbs hang from a so-called arm caddy. In fact, she's surrounded by life-size body parts.
And then I have a bunch of other heads like those ones like my other colleagues have worked on too.
Each design coming out of this studio meets the needs of specific retailers. And Peter Houston, who manages this brand for Fusion, says mannequins can change dramatically depending on what they're selling.
That's why for guest accessories, a tall, sleek mannequin that has actually the detail removed but gives you these beautiful fluid lines to accentuate accessories is a very appropriate and unique use of mannequins.
But the needs of guests are very different from those of Dick's Sporting Goods, which recently updated its mannequins to have more chiseled muscles and athletic poses. For Disney, Fusion created pint-sized mannequins after studying real kids at play. The price of creating a custom prototype can run companies from $12,000 to $24,000, and that's just getting started. Mass production for Fusion mannequins can run up to $550 each. By way of comparison, an everyday mannequin costs as little as $150. Not only is this custom mannequin process expensive, it can be painstaking. The molds are attached to a platter the size of a satellite dish. While it rotates, they're filled with a polyurethane substance. After the material dries, workers open up the mold like a cello case. The mannequins are sanded and prepped for the next stage, paint. There's a reason why retailers are willing to invest so much money into such a complicated process.
As online shopping grows and grows, it seems the people coming into the stores are even more and more interested in tactile experience.
Craig Childress is with EnviroCell, a New York City-based firm that studies consumer behavior. He says a well-designed mannequin will invite shoppers to interact with the merchandise.
It's really amazing to us how static retail environments are. So anything that actually has perception of moving or is actually moving really gets attention very quickly.
While it may start with action, a successful mannequin has to ultimately reflect something that customers want to see in themselves, according to Fusion Specialties' Peter Houston.
A well-designed mannequin will always be far more aspirational than it is realistic. And so you walk a fine line there.
A line retailers hope will lead right to the cash register. For NPR News, I'm Grace Hood.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Busey Bank, Unitarian Universalist Church, Urbana, Kirby Foods, Champaign, and A-Plus Farms Limited, Pine Village. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 1st of August, 2011. It's the birthday of the alchemist and spirit medium Edward Kelly in Worcester, England, 1555. Worked as an apothecary's assistant, studied at Oxford, and in his late 20s, he approached a very learned man named John Dee, who was a close consultant to Queen Elizabeth I, and Mr. Kelly offered his services as a seer. Kelly said that he was able to contact angels, that he had visions in his crystal ball.